expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from the studios of WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. And it is indeed a beautiful and lovely day, so thank you for taking time away from the sunshine, one of the great fall days of the year, to join us today in Media Matters. Hope you're outside if you're fortunate enough to do that. We have a terrific guest for you today, David Wallace, the founder and editorial director of FeatureWell.com, which is a syndicate representing more than 1,000 independent writers, is here to join us on the phones. He represents writers like Jimmy Breslin and Robert Reich, and he has interviewed, among other people, Vaclav Havel, Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford, and Lee Iacocca, and has contributed to the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, and the Times of London. He's the editor of the brand new book, which I hold in my hands now, which I've had the privilege to be reading the last few days, called Killed, Great Journalism Too Hot to Print, published by Nation Books, just coming out. We're going to talk about this book today, some of the pieces in it, and some of the implications of this book. We hope you'll enjoy the show and call in and speak with us. David Wallace, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob, for having me on the show.
Oh, it's really a treat to have you here. And again, I want to say the book is called Killed, Great Journalism Too Hot to Print. And it's a collection, really, of a number of outstanding articles that were rejected by editors of mostly magazines and a few newspapers over the last 25 years. Is that a correct description?
It's correct, though. I wouldn't just say they were rejected. I would say they were stories that were assigned. Mm-hmm. And once the stories came in, the editors got nervous or an external reason, not just, it wasn't quality that resulted in the killing of the article. It was more of a situation where fear of offending readers, fear of offending advertisers, cronyism in the media, the idea of one story in particular, you know, was a story by Mitch Albom. There was a review of a Mitch Albom's, his latest book.
That's the last chapter in the book, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, but it's the last piece in the book,
which is ordered chronologically, so it's a very recent piece.
It is, and yeah. But to me, it was one of the quintessential killed pieces for the book because it was a fine review of a piece by Mitch Albom. It was a very harsh review. It was negative. And his own paper, the Free Press, Album's own paper, had assigned it in order to a freelancer in order to avoid conflict of interest. Well, yeah, when they got in a negative review, they immediately spiked the story. And they showed themselves sort of protecting made members of the media mafia.
And as I read every chapter in this book and as I read your introduction, I mean, what jumps out and what you talk about in the introduction is that this has a tremendous ripple effect. I mean, just that example you gave about the Detroit Free Press and Mitch Albom, who's one of their top writers, their best-known writer probably in the whole newspaper. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going to happen to that freelancer? Is he going to be getting another gig from the Detroit Free Press, or is he now sort of, you know, on an informal blacklist?
Well, I think the informal blacklist does exist. Take it from me. I do believe that there is a lot of fear among independent writers out there. There's a very incestuous world of magazines and newspapers, and a lot of it is centered between 14th Street and 96th Street here in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, the labor practices of the magazine and newspaper industry for independent journalists, it's an incredible, it's a joke. Our conditions are pretty bad. We're the peace workers of the literary world. And, writers are afraid to question a contract. They're afraid to question, their pay. A lot of people might not know this, but for independent journalists, pay is something like half of what it was, according to the National Writers Union, in the 60s.
So, I mean, the situation is really deteriorating. It's not just that it's always been a lousy situation.
I think it has been deteriorating for a number of reasons, but one of the main ones, and this is something you, of course, know more than most people about, is the idea of media consolidation, where there used to be, we've lost two-thirds of our independent newspapers, for instance, in the last, since 1975. Now, There are clearly more outlets today, you know, in terms of the internet and all that sort of thing. But the major mainstream players are fewer and fewer. So when Time Inc., for instance, decides to take all rights from a writer and not allow a writer to resell his work, that really is a huge thing. It's they're one of four or five major players that exists now in magazines.
And I mean,
there's not much you can do about it.
I mean, I think also the ability to post an article on a website's well and good, but if you're a writer who's trying to do this, you need to be able to support yourself. You need to have an income.
Very few blogs are paying big money. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, and so we're really talking about a very small pool of paying gigs where writers can actually hope to support themselves so they have the time to do good work.
Yes, that's true, and I think it's become harder, and I also think it's easier to be labeled a troublemaker or to be labeled as difficult and not get work. So I think there are a lot of informal blacklists. I'll give you one anecdote, which happened to me when I was researching the book. I found a piece from a writer who will remain nameless, and he was going to put it in the book. He submitted it to the book. It was a piece on abortion doctors in some states who do a shoddy job and have killed women. Now, it should be said that these are just a few of, I'm sure, you know, plenty of decent doctors out there. These were the few bad apples that he focused on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking at state regulation, you know, that it was sort of weak in some cases. So a perfectly reasonable story to investigate, in my opinion. Well, the editor of a major women's magazine felt differently. She worried, quote, that it would hurt the movement. And so not only on the right, but on the left, there's some self-censorship that goes on. Anyway, this writer pulled the piece from my book.
Hmm.
He ultimately decided, he said to me, David, if I give you this piece and some of the women's magazines find out, because we named each, in Killed, we named the killie. We named the killer. We named the publication that spiked the story. And he said to me, I'll lose 15% of my income if I give you the story. And he pulled the piece.
Mm-hmm. And I also...
What I'll say is that some of the traditional folks who are meant to question powerful interests, I think there is some nervousness among us.
We're talking to David Wallace today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David Wallace is the editor of the brand new book, Killed, Great Journalism Too Hot to Print, just out with Nation Books. We're going to be talking about Killed today on Media Matters. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the telephone number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And I want to recommend this book strongly to listeners. If you're interested in journalism and great writing, this is truly a page-turner. I get books almost every week for this show, and I read them and enjoy them. But this was one that was absolute pleasure to go through as I read it. And I think if you like great writing, great magazine journalism, and I suspect many of our listeners do, I'd urge you to take a look at it. One thing you also do, David, in the book, which I think makes it really great, is at the beginning of each of the pieces, and I don't know, what are there, roughly 15 or 20 pieces in the book?
There are 24 pieces.
24, okay. At the beginning of each piece, there's an explanation of the story behind its being killed. So you get a little context for it, which is actually very helpful.
Joe Connison called it an obituary note.
Yeah, and it makes you appreciate the piece even more. And strikingly, although most of the pieces are from the last 10 years, and a lot are just from the last 3 or 4 years, you start with sort of a few of the truly giants of magazine journalism or writing, really.
I wanted to put the book in historical context. I want people to understand that, yes, killing has, you know, I jokingly call it a, you know, story side. You know, Mark Twain had stories killed. Emma Goldman had stories killed. Richard Wright, you know, couldn't get published during the Cold War. Practically had a hell of a hard time. He was, when he moved to France, he even submitted a story to Ebony magazine, and it was considered. It was called It was about why he chose exile, and they killed the story. So I mean, it's nothing new. I would say the phenomenon has increased, but I wanted to put in the Orwell piece.
Yeah, that's the opening pieces by George Orwell.
It's a book review by George Orwell, and I had Christopher Hitchens, who has done a biography of Orwell, write the introduction to that piece. And the story goes that Orwell did a book review of a book that poked some fun and questioned the behavior of expat businessmen in Southeast Asia during wartime and war profiteering, while people, both soldiers and the people there, were struggling and suffering. So it was deemed unpatriotic during a time of war. And Orwell, you know, vowed that he would never write again for the Observer of London, which killed the piece. Hitchens points out in his introduction that ultimately we have to be careful what we say, because he said that the Observer's publisher ended up paying for Orwell's funeral expenses, because Orwell was pretty broke at the time of his death. It's only afterwards that his books have stolen at a clip.
Mm-hmm. And after Orwell, you got the next piece is by Betty Friedan, another really living legend at this point.
I think that was one of the most fascinating pieces, I'll tell you. First of all, it's called Why Are Women Wasting Their Time in College? And Friedan wrote it in 1958, and she wrote it for McCall's. And it was basically looking at how women were at the time not using college for studies, but really trying to meet men and find husbands. And she was imploring women at her alma mater, Smith College, to take college far more seriously. So that was a message that McCall's did not want readers to for whatever reason, I guess it's just a different time, but they didn't want published readers to have that access to that message. Now, the beauty of that piece is that Friedan then submitted it to another couple of women's magazines, and it was rejected again and again. But it inspired her to write The Feminine Mystique, which is one of the most important books of the latter part of the 20th century.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes, arguably, getting killed, having a story killed, is a positive thing. Because, you know, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men originally was a story that was killed by Fortune. And it evolved from that. So some good things do happen when you're rejected.
But in general, good things don't happen. I mean, the moral of the story is it's not a good thing that this great writing, much of it really hasn't seen much of the light of day before this book, wasn't available to the American people.
Well, I think there are profound ramifications to an editor's decisions. One of the most egregious examples of a story being killed, in my opinion, was a short one in the book. It was by... the great, he's a really wonderful magazine writer named Eric Hedegaard, who was a staff writer at Rolling Stone. And he did a piece on John, sort of a profile of John Mellencamp.
Mm-hmm.
Mellencamp at the time had a massive heart attack. He had lost 8% of his heart, and he had been smoking, I think, up to 80 cigarettes a day before his heart attack. He was still smoking after his heart attack against doctor's orders.
Wow.
Eric Hedegaard was sent by Details to smoke, to have a few cigarettes with John Mellencamp after his heart attack. Now, unlike a lot of the celebrity pap that you read today, the profiles that are sort of dictated by publicists, this is a great piece where Hedegaard, you know, reveals that Mellencamp smoked during sex at times and was just miserable about his addiction to cigarettes. But the editors of Details magazine somehow decided to show that piece to the advertising department. That there would be no way that story would run in Details magazine. And of course, at the time, Details was accepting advertising from big tobacco companies. And I found a lot of.
I'm just surprised. I would have thought the cigarette companies would have been excited that there's a new use for cigarette smoking
during sex.
Yeah,
he called it the lazy boy position, L-A-Y. I'm not on camp.
Now, you said that Details magazine, which is owned by Condé Nast, then did not accept cigarette advertising, or did accept it. Do they not accept it now?
I think that as part of the tobacco settlement, Big Tobacco is no longer advertising in mainstream magazines, as far as I know. I don't think they're accepting ads of the kind now, but, you know, these editors, I mean, first of all, the editor of Details Magazine wasn't the only editor who had killed a story on tobacco. Many stories about the dangers of tobacco were killed. I found, for instance, the New Republic had killed a piece by David Owen, who's now at the New Yorker. It was a story, funnily enough, it was about how the media gives velvety coverage to the tobacco industry.
You know?
So they killed that piece back when they were accepting advertising in the 80s. So I found a lot of instances, and my question is, those editors mm-hmm. who killed stories on tobacco and kept the public from knowing as much as they could have on the issue actually have, in my opinion, blood on their hands.
We're talking to David Wallace today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David Wallace is the founder and editorial director of FeatureWell.com, a syndicate representing over 1,000 independent writers, including Jimmy Breslin and Robert Reich. And he is also the editor of the brand new book, Killed, Great Journalism Too Hot to Print, that we're talking about today. And if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the phone lines are open. The number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I want to talk about some of the general themes of the book and the conditions of being a writer in the commercial media environment, magazine writing environment in New York, that small incestuous world you've been describing. But first, I do want to talk about one more of the opening pieces after Friedan and Orwell, which was the third piece, Terry Southern, Check Up with Dr. Strangelove. And this piece was especially poignant for me because I just rewatched Dr. Strangelove 2 weeks ago, having not seen it for 2 decades, and was struck by, more than ever before, what a brilliant film it was, which made this piece that much stronger. Talk a little bit about this piece.
I put in some stories that were just historic artifacts, or they were pleasures for me to read, and they weren't the killed for the most controversial reasons. I think that Terry Southern was typecast as a gonzo journalist by his editors at Esquire. And when he turned in a rather serious profile of Stanley Kubrick from the set of Dr. Strangelove, which he ended up, you know, partially writing, Southern was invited by Kubrick to help write the script for Dr. Strangelove. It was maybe a little more reverential and calling the film in advance one of the most important films that we're going to see. You know, the editors at Esquire just were expecting more, you know, here's the gossip and here's the Terry Southern partying with Kubrick at London clubs. It just wasn't that way. So while that piece wasn't killed for a controversial reason, particularly, I just felt it necessary. It had never been published before, and I came across it, and I felt it important to put in the book. It does talk, very presciently about the idea of preemption as a military tactic, which struck me as, you know, particularly relevant given, you know, the Iraq debate. So that's why I put in. I had some guilty pleasures. Another one was, I don't know if you have read yet, but there was a story about a satire of a restaurant fair, and it followed around Big Boy, mm-hmm. the mascot for the Big Boy chain, mm-hmm. and it was a total farce about really trade magazine writing, mm-hmm. and it followed around Bosco Bear and the Jolly Green Giant and all these characters. And it was really just such a fun read. But it was killed by Granta because they thought somehow that it was true. And when they found out that it was fiction, there was a miscommunication, I suppose. They spiked the story. And so I do have some cases where I just, you know, I thought, wow, this is just such fun. I got to put it in.
Yeah, that, and also the Terry Southern piece qualifies. Because it was just, I mean, it just, the words jump off the page. They're so wonderful.
Yeah, one of my, here's a piece. There's one other piece in the book that was both an entertaining read, but also made you think about the state of journalism today. And it was by Larry Doyle, and Larry Doyle is a former writer at The Simpsons, and he was also an editor at a lot of major magazines. So he's a wonderful humorist, and he was I guess former National Lampoon guy, and Us magazine in the, I guess, the 90s decided, let's get Larry Doyle to write a satire about Hollywood publicists.
Mm-hmm.
So he followed around. He created the character of Petra Geist, who is this absolute nightmarish Hollywood publicist who's on the phone with Tina Brown trying to you know, manipulate coverage of magazine coverage. And one of the basic crux of the piece is that she represents a movie maker who kills himself, and yet it's partly because he's made a terrible film, but she somehow manipulates the press to this being the PR agent makes this film a big deal despite it being terrible, and uses the death of quote one of her close friends to make it a bigger product. And this piece obviously struck too close to home for the editors of Us. And they worried, from what I interviewed one of the editors who killed it, and he said, you know, we were really concerned that we would lose access. And that's just a word I hear more and more these days, the idea that if you're going to upset a publicist in Hollywood, you won't get that cover that sells a few more issues of the magazine, and you'll be fired.
Yeah, access. Access seems to me like one of those words that's antithetical to journalism. I mean, it's like a corporate PR word or something. I don't know where it comes from. We're talking to David Wallace today on Media Matters. He's the editor of the new book, Killed, Great Journalism Too Hot to Print. The phone number here, 333-9455. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with David Wallace.
Yeah, hi. Boy, I am so tired of the same story in every newspaper in the country, no matter what city you pick up a paper from. The stories are the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just pick them off the AP wires or whatever. Nobody reports on anything anymore. Everybody's afraid of controversy. Everybody's afraid to be politically incorrect. Nobody wants to dig into the real truth. When truth does come out, it's buried on inside pages. Is there any way that your organization or a new organization could come up with a newspaper, a magazine,
mm-hmm.
that would have point counterpoint so that people could really, you know, compare things and see all aspects of a story in depth?
Well, one of the things I've been talking about lately is the prayer that I have. And the prayer is that George Soros will swoop down and plunk down $100 million and will form a chain will create a new nonprofit newspaper in America with a new chain with editions in one paper towns such as Oklahoma City and New Orleans and Galveston, Texas, places I've traveled in recent years where I've picked up the paper and gone, oh my God, I can't believe what I'm reading. It's so terrible and one-sided. And yet you're right. A lot of publications have cut back on their foreign coverage and, you know, mainly, I would argue, partly because of consolidation, they're all worried about profits rather than quality. So AP is a lot cheaper than posting one of your correspondents in London.
Well, nobody does any of it. Yeah, here in Champaign, I mean, it's unless you write the story yourself, you can't even get it in the newspaper because they don't have any, quote, reporters anymore, you know. They call them reporters, but they don't actually go out and report.
I think there's still a lot of good local coverage that goes on. I think that Americans are, you know, and while the Internet provides access for many Americans to get news from alternative sources, I think for the most part, most people are still getting their news through big corporate sources, including AP and Reuters and even the Internet sites like CNN.com. So I think you have to work harder for the information. I think it's out there. We're in a better place than we were 30 years ago.
It's so difficult to get that many people just don't bother. They don't have time. You know, if you can...
I forget who said it, but, you know, there's an old saying If you don't do politics, politics will do you. And
yes, and
what
that's
I would
what's
say
happening.
Is
that, and it's very frightening what's happening
I
right
think people
now.
Need to make
very, very scary.
People need to make the time. They need to go online and they need to read things like the Guardian, the AFR in Australia, and the Sydney Morning Herald, and other English language press, in order to get a fuller story.
Well, thank you very much, caller, for calling. I appreciate your comments. I should add before we go to our next caller that David Wallace is going to be coming to town, not actually literally to Champaign-Urbana, but rather to our sister pair of twin cities, Bloomington Normal. David, do you know the exact date of that trip?
That's October 14th.
October 14th.
I'm going to be at university at, let's see.
It's Illinois State University in Normal.
Yeah. And I'm there I think around noon.
Yeah, it's a whole day of events on media that you'll be featured at in a series of events. And what our listeners who want to learn more about this, what they can do is sign up for the Media Matters weekly email, and we'll have all the information on that. And you can get that simply by sending an email to our producer, Victor Picard, VPICKARD, at UIUC.edu. You'll get a weekly email with all the sorts of information. You get no spam. You can get off the list whenever you want. We don't share our list with anyone. But then we can have all this sort of information for you if you want it. I should add that Victor Picard is on assignment this week in London, England. And sitting in today is John Anderson as our producer. I want to thank John for being here. John is working now on a new show, which we call Media Minutes, which will be appearing as a feature part of Media Matters in the near future. And I think everyone's going to enjoy that. David Wallace, our guest today on Media Matters. He's the editor of the new book, Killed, Great Journalism Too Hot to Print. If you want to call in with a question or comment, the number 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with David Wallace.
San Francisco again, calling. I almost feel it's a sad day when with the media, when we have to hope that a sugar daddy like George Soros will come in and save America. You know, why not Bill Gates? And I'm calling mainly because I think one of the most, the thing that's almost been too hot for everyone to print is how Linux is so much better than Windows. And everywhere you go, including in this city, or the news that I look at, the mainstream news, no one really compares the two. A lot of mandarins in the business know the pluses and the cost savings of Linux, but it's incredible. I noticed in the Chronicle here, the last article they mentioned happened about the time that they had a huge Linux conference here in the city, and all they mentioned in the newspaper basically was that most businesses are scared to move to Linux, and the percentage that use Linux is very small. I would also mention one of the incredible things is that I think that journalists who really cover this story find that they have a difficult time for a number of reasons, and I could really go into that, but I don't want to take up too much time.
Well, thank you, Harl. Let's hear what David Wallace has to say about that. David?
I'm not a big tech guy, so I don't know about the difference between Linux and Windows, but I will say that I wouldn't be surprised that Microsoft is probably a mammoth advertiser, and I do think that the wall between editorial and the business side of publications used to be called the Chinese Wall to protect editors from outside influences. My joke is it's really now the Chinese fence, and it's a rickety one.
Yeah, you know, you've talked earlier that there are certain types of stories clearly that would hurt commercial concerns, like advertising stories about cigarettes, for example, which are legion, not just the example in the book, but other examples of how writers learn that that's just not a welcome story. Are there...
You ever see a today, you know, Hummer...
That's right.
The big car company, you know. Can you imagine a magazine that was reliant on Hummer talking about how big gas guzzlers they are? No, they'll just glorify. You ever seen a travel section, a negative story about any destination? You won't, because for the most part, travel sections and newspapers are reliant on the advertising of the destinations. You know, they're not going to take on the Hawaii anything about Hawaii that's negative, because the whole Hawaii tourist board, you know, might pull advertising. I really think that there's more corporate control of the media, and the newspaper industry worships at the altar of Wall Street. I think they're not going to do anything to jeopardize advertisers. And I'll also point out, I'm sure you've mentioned this in the past, but you know, a lot of editors today are paid not on the performance of their newspaper in terms of Pulitzers, but they're paid, you know, by stock and their performance of the bottom line. So let me ask you: is it more or less likely for an editor to spike a story that might affect the bottom line of his newspaper, and with for instance lawsuits? There's a lot of fear of lawsuits that goes on. We think we have a free press in this country. We think that our libel laws are protecting journalists. Believe me, nuisance lawsuits puts a chill in the airwaves.
You know, what about political biases outside of commercial ones? You've already talked about sort of a bias by a liberal feminist editor against a piece that she perceived as being perhaps not the undermining support for abortion rights. Is there a political bias, any patterns in it, or is it sort of random? Does it run left? Does it run right?
I actually think it transcends partisanship. I'll tell you a story, my favorite story from the right. Well, first of all, there's in recent months there was the story about the Lexington Herald Leader, and they're a paper in Kentucky, and they finally got around to talking about how they ignored a big story that civil rights movement thing, and they ignored the civil rights movement in the '60s, and they finally got around to doing an expose. I guess a month or two ago, or 3 months ago.
All right.
About how they had not ever photographed or talked about the protest that sprung up in Lexington, Kentucky. But a more recent story is, you know, an editorial cartoonist, acquaintance of mine, had done a cartoon after Bush had said, do you remember the Bring 'Em On statement that got so much play?
I think all of our listeners are familiar with that.
Okay, so after that statement, cartoonist in Scranton, Pennsylvania, drew Bush at a podium saying, bring him on, and he was in front of an audience of military coffins, and it said, Iraq War Dead. And his newspaper said, forget it, they're not going to run it, and they gave him an order, no more Bush cartoons. So
wow.
even editorial cartoonists now face you know, a culture of censorship that exists. And I'll give you another, you know, speaking of coffins, you know, how many newspapers today reported, I guess it was a few months ago, that the Senate voted by a fairly large margin to ban news organizations from publishing photos of military coffins. And that's a story that was played on page A17 of the New York Times, a little brief item, and should have been on the front page, but at least they covered it. A lot of newspapers didn't even, you know, address this attack on press freedom.
We're talking to David Wallace today, editor of the new book, Killed, Great Journalism Too Hot to Print, just out by Nation Books. We have a couple phone lines open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with David Wallace.
Yeah, thanks. You know, another example I've heard about recently is in medical journals, where articles are scuttled if the drug that's being under study turns out to work poorly, because so many of this research is funded by the drug companies, and if it just doesn't come out the way they want it, then the article's just not published.
David?
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, I haven't heard of those cases, but shouldn't surprise anyone that our media is tiptoeing around advertisers. And you know, I believe that there is now a movement among medical editors to, in some ways, I read a little something about this, that they're now starting to take some action to, and I don't know how they're doing it, but they are aware of the issue, and it's starting to crop up, and I guess they're starting to get chastised for it. And you know what? Magazine and newspaper circulation is going down, and even if advertising rates or advertising sales are going up, people aren't reading their newspapers and magazines to a much less degree than they did. Maybe it has something to do with the internet, whatever. All I can say is that until journalists are more trusted, and with Jason Blair, with Jack Kelly at USA Today, and with other questionable practices, along with killing stories when we learn about stories that are killed unfairly, it erodes the trust in the media. And when you ultimately, it affects the bottom line. But I don't think necessarily the publishing executives have really figured that out just yet.
That might seem too far down the road with short-term profits staring them in the face. You know, David, how many journalists in the United States today who are freelance writers who aren't salaried journalists or nonfiction feature writers support themselves at a living wage? How many actually, you know, of the thousands out there trying to do this sort of work can actually make a living?
Well, I don't know the answer particularly, but I'll say that I would estimate that it's a much smaller number than you might think. And independent journalists play an important role.
I'm pretty skeptical. You might even be surprised.
I think that independent journalists play a really important role in our democracy. Now, the reason being, staff writers are often under incredible time constraints. And I think that independent journalists, and especially the investigative reporters who are independent, are able to give more time and effort sometimes to stories that matter. Now, it's harder and harder to find homes for those stories because a lot of publications have, you know, there might be more publications, but I think a friend of mine quoted Bruce Springsteen, 57 channels and nothing on. It's I think harder to find. I mean, a publication where you can put out a investigation. Granted that the New Yorker and the New Republic and Atlantic, and there are a few major publications that still exist, but I think they're far and fewer between. I lament that.
We're talking to David Walsh today in Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with David Wallace.
Hello, very good conversation. Thank you. I started to call in trying to raise the issue of why aren't there more Seymour Hirsches out there really doing the job and selling magazines at the same time. That doesn't seem to upset the advertisers of the New Yorker, but you're right, they're few and far between that can have the luxury of going out and doing an investigative story for a long time. Some newspapers do have investigative teams that aren't under time constraints and go out and get the story, but not enough, certainly.
I bet you that there's cost cutting in the newsroom.
Right.
One of the first places that they look to is someone who's not producing five stories a week.
Regularly. But my main thing is for that caller from Champaign that said, where is there a magazine that calls the errors? Extra, which comes from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, is a marvelous magazine that calls broadcast and print media to account on errors. And I would say we could just engage in a kind of media activism on our personal level, tell neighbors and write letters whenever we see or learn about an error, plant seeds of doubt, encourage turning to alternative sources. There are a lot on the internet, as you mentioned, and just those seeds of doubt because the errors have been egregious. I remember Edward Said in his book covering Islam pointed out something horrible that Newsweek had said and that went around the world, you know, as truth. And so there's no perfect medium, but we could write letters constantly telling them we expect better.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Do you have some comments, David?
I'll say this, that a lot of people look to blogs and the internet as our saviors, and everyone can be a publisher today. And, well, I think it's a minority, maybe the intelligentsia, who are getting their news from blogs. But I think they only matter when the mainstream media generally picks up on stories created by blogs. I think still far more people are getting their news from, you know, ABC, CBS, and NBC to this day at 6:30 on their local news, on their national news. But I do think that blogs have increasingly are playing an important role as sort of the cops of journalism, and doing a fantastic job of pointing out when journalists are falling flat in their face.
You know, I want to talk about one piece in here that goes more to the political issues, which is probably the most famous, or certainly one of the most famous contemporary reporters you have in here, is Robert Fisk, the award-winning English Mideast reporter who's been covering the region for 25 years. And you've got a piece in here that was killed by Harper's, a fairly liberal magazine. And could you tell, what's the story there?
It's called Remembering the Wise. And it looks at the media coverage, which Fisk argues is pro-Israeli and not balanced. And he particularly looked at the use of the word terrorist. And it was written after he was beaten up in Pakistan by I guess, several Muslims. And he even looked at the word mob, how we use the word mob when we're covering Muslims. In the press, but he particularly looked at the word terrorist and how he argued that we don't refer to the Falangist soldiers who were responsible for the massacre in a Palestinian refugee camp, and I can't remember the year, at Shatila. He argued that we should refer to them also as terrorists. And so I think that the Middle East is such a touchy topic. And I had a few stories in the book about the Middle East that, you know, just editors didn't want to touch. I think my favorite in the whole book was also by Mike Sager, who's a great magazine journalist from Esquire. But he, as a young reporter, did a piece during the First Intifada. He went to Israel and lived with Palestinians, and it was a piece that really humanized Palestinians at a time when I think there was probably a little less sympathy in the media for the Palestinians at the time. And he really did, I think, a service by letting people know that they weren't just terrorists. And the Washington Post magazine spiked that story. It's I think, the best piece of writing I have in the book.
Oh, that's high praise.
Yeah. I think it was a long piece, but I just can't understand why they decided to kill it. But they before he went to Israel, an editor at the Washington Post pulled him aside. He'd worked there previously as a reporter, but he had been a freelancer when he had decided to do the story for the Washington Post magazine, I guess in 87. And he pulled him aside, this editor, a grizzled old editor, and the guy said, "Be careful what you say and do and write, because there are larger implications here." And apparently there were, because the story never saw the light of day until it was published and killed.
We're talking to David Wallace today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David is the editor of the brand new book, Killed, Great Journalism Too Hot to Print, just out with Nation Books. We're going to go back to the phone lines now. We've got a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with David Wallace.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about the
I think we've got a bad connection here, line 2.
Sorry, I'm out.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to ask you to call in again and hang up here.
I'll just get on another phone.
Okay. What we'll do now is go to another phone call while line 2 tries to rehook up. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with David Wallace.
Hi, yes. I'd like to say that I do love this program. I think you're covering very important issues. What you're discussing today is one of many examples of trivialization and marginalization of media. And it's good that it's being acknowledged, but you aren't really discussing why this happens. And I'd like to hear a bit more on that. And, for example, what's the difference between having a hot story, which happens to be political in terms of sales or whatever it is that matters to people, compared to a scandal, which seems to be exactly what the newspapers do want? I'll hang up and listen to your discussion of that.
I think the caller is talking a little bit about what I call the celebrification of the media today, where it's much easier to sell a story about a starlet's drug problem or eating disorder than it is about, let's say, the labor movement. And that's just, that is a fact of life today. And it is crowding, and there's a type of self-censorship that goes on in the decisions that editors make. And clearly, there's a lot of crowding out that goes on. I think your associate, Ben Scott, who I had been on a panel with recently, was talking about how, newspapers used to have labor sections in mm-hmm. their newspaper. Now, it's rare that they have a labor reporter who writing about the struggles of working people.
Yeah, Ben Scott, in fact, was the first producer of Media Matters. You got your start here.
Oh, good, good.
Yeah, there we go.
But the caller said, you know, we're not talking about the reasons why. Let's go through them just one more time.
Sure, let's do.
You know, some of the reasons. Media consolidation creates outlets that are more concerned about bottom lines than the editorial quality.
And there's less competitive pressure on them to act differently.
All right. That's one reason I think stories are killed today that matter. Certainly, stories are killed for all sorts of legitimate reasons. You know, a competitor gets the scoop first, or the writing is dreadful. But I'm talking about stories that matter that could get killed.
And also, if I can add one thing that you made clear, the stories that are killed in here weren't killed because there was a sense that readers wouldn't be interested in them. These are all stories that readers would like. I mean, there were other factors.
There were concerns. There was one story in the book about a doll maker who made little mini Mengeles. And it was killed by the New Yorker after September 11th. So I think they were overprotective of their readers. So there is, in some cases, some things that are not politically correct, and that stories that I picked up. But
what I meant, for commercial reasons, there's not a sense here that these are stories that would bore readers, that they would just not read the magazine or ever buy it again, that's what the impetus was not to run them.
I don't believe that's why stories got killed.
Yeah.
Fear of lawsuits killed a story about the body shop in the book, an investigation of their business practices that are less green than you might think. We have the political bias in the newsroom, both on the right and the left, that kills stories. There's no question that fear of upsetting advertisers affects the judgment of editors, and I think that in a recent Pew study, one-third of editors admitted that they avoid stories that would rile advertisers. So those are some of the reasons why pieces get killed unfairly.
Now, David, assuming you get to the front of the line finally to meet George Soros, and that'll be a long wait, I suspect, and he doesn't come through, he's tapped out or he's doing something else.
Well, then I guess I'll go to Bill Gates, as the first book caller, Linux fan, suggests.
But is it basically down to philanthropy by people with billions of dollars is the only hope in your view?
Well, I will hope that internet advertising takes off more than it has. And I think that as the industry matures, we will see independent publications that can survive on the net. However, I would say that we're going to see the same thing happen in the mainstream print media that we do online, which is as publications succeed online, they'll be snapped up and there'll be more consolidation. I think the one thing that can be done is, we can only hope that an FCC that we have a Democratic administration, or even the Democrats might not do anything about it, but we change the media ownership laws that allow so many publications to be gobbled up. Mm-hmm. And allow TV broadcasters to also own newspapers.
I think maybe this is a point we don't have much time left, but I mean, I don't know if many of our listeners would appreciate the fact that in the New York magazine publishing world, which is really where almost all the significant national magazines are published, there's really only a few companies that more or less own all the titles.
A handful of companies that control much of the magazine.
I mean, there's Time Warner, there's Condé Nast, which is owned by Newhouse. Who else?
Brunner and Yar.
Mm-hmm. And that's owned by Bertelsmann, the massive German conglomerate. So you've got a few companies that really own the overwhelming majority of the circulation.
That's true.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. We have a patient caller, I think, is trying again to use the phone system here. Champaign County, you're on the air with David Wallace.
Yeah, I'll be terse. I wanted you to talk about the this is titled Killed, but what about the unborn? Let's put the extend the metaphor a bit. And they must interact. I mean, I think there are more stories that are self-censored than are actually actively done in, but it's pretty true that if Fisk can't even get in Harper's, you know, who amongst these corporate-dominated reporters are going to pitch a story that, you know, goes anywhere?
I think you're absolutely right. I think we're increasingly, one of the results of niche media or the fragmentation of the media, where there are fewer general interest magazines, is that we're seeing what I call preach to the choir journalism. And you're less likely today to, from a liberal point of view, approach the Wall Street Journal with an op-ed, or from a conservative point of view, approach, for instance, The Nation. And I do think, and this just, I don't have any empirical evidence to say otherwise, but I do think in my gut that publications were more likely 10, 15, 20 years ago to publish an opposing view. You know, the other day I was on my website, I had a piece that came in, and it was called How FDR Made African Americans, the Lives of African Americans Worse. It was a controversial topic, and I passed by it, you know, and it was so, I went back and I put it up on the site because I just felt it made an argument. It wasn't in any way an outrageous argument. The writer did a good job at least making his argument. I didn't agree with him, but I felt it necessary to put it up. Now, that took sort of avoiding my editorial reflex to say, the last thing I need is to have the hassle of upset people who are going to read this thing. But ultimately, I think it's better when we have a wider source of views.
David Wallace, it's been great having you on the show today. We're almost out of time. Just a closing comment. Can you tell us a little bit, how has the book been received so far?
It's been interesting, actually. It's been getting great reviews. We've got positive reviews in places like Salon and the St. Louis Dispatch and San Francisco Chronicle and the New York Post even. A lot of... Pardon?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We have had really about 20 or 30 good reviews. What was interesting is that a lot of the bigger publications, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, for instance, and the LA Times, totally ignored the book for the most part. And I've actually been published in all those publications.
Well, on that note, we'll have to say that readers will have to go, or listeners will have to go read the book themselves and see why it's been ignored by some of them. I want to thank you, David Wallace, very much for joining me, Bob McChesney, today on Media Matters.
Thank you.
Good luck with the book. And I want to thank John Anderson for ably sitting in for Victor Picard as producer today on the program. And thank you all for listening. We'll be back 1 week from today on Media Matters. Until then, have a great fall.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Prairie Boat Works, Champaign; Lincoln Diagnostics Incorporated, Decatur; and Body Work Associates in Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high in the mid-80s and southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 50 degrees and east winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high in the lower 80s and southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. WILL-AM broadcasts from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, made possible by a generous gift from Alice and Robert Campbell. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.